When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Las Vegas. It's so much more than just a city.
It's a feeling. It's that feeling of excitement when you spot the lights of the strip out the airplane window.
It's that feeling of awe as you stroll down the boulevard, taking in the sights and sounds.
And it's that feeling of satisfaction, knowing that you're in the greatest city in the world.
Tens of millions of people share that feeling every year.
And I'm just one of them. Here to take you to the world-famous Vegas Strip
and beyond,
my name is Jeff, and this is Jeff Does Vegas. Welcome to another special bonus episode of Jeff Does Vegas. I'm now a little over 5 years into my Vegas podcasting adventure, and in that time, I've completed well over 200 episodes, including bonus and special episodes. Back in the early days of the show, I covered some pretty interesting topics and had conversations with some pretty incredible guests. Unfortunately, a lot of those episodes are now buried deep in the podcast archives, and the chances of new listeners discovering them are pretty low. So, in order to save you from having to go digging for them, I've put together a feature I'm calling From the Vault, where I reshare what I consider to be some of the best content from the early days of the podcast. And this time around, we're going to talk about the science of smell. If you've ever been to Las Vegas, you're well aware of the unique scents of the various casinos and hotels up and down the strip. In fact, if you ask people what one of their favorite parts of going to Vegas is, they'll often tell you it's the smell inside the casinos. And it seems that everyone has their preferred casino scent. So much so that there are literally thousands of posts online from people asking how they can either purchase or replicate their favorite casino scent. But what's the big deal about smell? Why is the scent of a casino so important that the companies that own them spend literally millions of dollars on the development and distribution of these so-called signature scents? To get the answer, I turn to an expert. Back on episode number 79 of the podcast, I was joined by Dr. Rachel Herz. Dr. Herz is a cognitive neuroscientist, a TEDx speaker, published author, and a world-renowned expert on the psychological science of smell. In addition, Dr. Herz has worked as a consultant for multiple international corporations on the development of fragrances and flavors, including the company that was first responsible for installing scent vaporizer systems in the Mirage back in 1991. Dr. Herz and I discussed how the sense of smell works, the connection between scents and emotions and memory, how businesses use scent to affect customer behavior, and much more. Please enjoy my conversation with Dr. Rachel Herz.
It was a strange path of least resistance while I was in graduate school. And I did my undergraduate actually at Queen's and had a double major in biology and psychology, sort of ended up at the end doing a thesis in the psychology department, but it was biological psychology and what would be called neuroscience right now. And then when I ended up going to graduate school, I had decided that I didn't want to do animal research anymore, which is what I had been doing. I wanted to work with humans. And I was trying to figure out a way to sort of bring the biology, psychology concepts together and actually sort of struggling with different topics and different supervisors and trying to find the right niche. And actually, I was taking a course. This was at the University of Toronto. I was taking a course during the PhD work and read a paper where the researchers used smell to manipulate mood. And this was totally novel at the time. The traditional methods were verbal and, you know, maybe something like with music potentially, but mainly these sort of very what are called demand characteristic laden kinds of methods where the person really knows what's going on, like try to get into a really good mood or try to get into a bad mood and think about these sad things and so on. And the researchers who wrote about this in the paper gave this detailed kind of evolutionary explanation for why they thought that smell was so perfect at being able to change mood. And since I had been interested in mood and memory, this was something that was going through my work up until that point, I sort of had this, you know, light bulb go off that studying the sense of smell was a perfect way to marry the biology and the psychology together. And luckily, I had a supervisor that didn't care that I didn't do anything that he did. And actually, nobody in the department really did anything connected to this at all. And I cobbled together a thesis committee and actually drove down to the U.S. With my boyfriend at the time. It was one of those kind of classic crazy trips where we went to visit people in different places, including actually at Brown University, where the person who actually founded the psychological study of smell was. And this is Trey Gengen, who sadly is no longer with us, but he was super wonderful and generous and gave me a huge stack of papers and books. And at the same time, I also went to IFF, which is International Flavors and Fragrances, and they make the aroma chemicals that go into scenting all kinds of things from personal care products to, you know, background aromas used everywhere. And that we still joke about it today about the crazy Canadian graduate student who showed up on their doorstep and said, could you please give me some fragrances I need for my research? And that was the start of the whole beginning of a career.
And I mean, we can get into this a little bit more in depth later on as we talk about the connection between emotion and memory and scent. But was there a personal reason for you to choose this as a specialty?
Well, there was sort of one more pedantic and one, I guess, more personal. One, the more pedantic one was while I was studying for the GREs to get into graduate school, one of the questions on the exam was, what sense is most connected to memory? And the answer was a sense of smell. And I asked my supervisor who I was working with at Queen's why that was. And he didn't have an answer for me. It was like, well, it just is. And that always really bothered me because I felt like, well, there must be a reason why. And first of all, you know, is this also true and so on. So that kind of stuck in my craw. But I guess also more personally, I've always been a very like sort of in quotations, sensory or sensual person in the sense that I love, you know, smelling things, touching things. You know, when I was a kid, my mother was always like slapping my hand, stop squeezing the bread, you know, stuff like that. And so I've sort of the idea of studying the senses was definitely kind of there from a personal perspective. And maybe also something from a personal perspective was we moved a lot when I was a kid. And one of the things that stood out for me as one of the strange things that it was part of my experiences, although I didn't know it was strange at the time, was that I actually really liked the smell of skunk. And that's because the first time I ever smelled it, we were in the countryside, you know, we're driving along a beautiful bucolic day, and I didn't know what it was. I smell something, my mom from the front seat says, oh, I love that smell. And it turned out it was a smell of skunk. So I love my mother. This is like one of the ways that emotional associations to scent are formed. So in any case, that's why I have such a positive association. And when I had first moved to Montreal, when I was about 7, I made the grave mistake of saying, you know, I like the smell of skunk. And, you know, children at that age are extremely mean and cruel. And I was severely ridiculed, you know, on top of being the weird new kid. And so that was something that I always felt like, you know, was my shame. And then later on in life, I met other people that liked the smell of skunk too. So it was kind of like this thing about, okay, I'm a weirdo smelly person. So now I have some connections with other people. So I'm going to go for it.
It's interesting that you bring up the idea of a positive association with what could be a negative smell. I kind of have a similar experience or a similar situation with a bunch of books that I inherited from my grandfather when he passed away. I open up those books and I take a big whiff. And for me, that smell takes me right back to my childhood and the time I spent with them as a kid and at their house and on vacation. Whereas my wife, to her, it just smells like a musty basement. And in her mind, it's like, you got to air out these books.
Yeah. Well, you're hitting on a really important point, which is the connection between how our associations get formed with smell and our personal connections and our childhood associations being especially potent. But the other thing that is important as well is that actually everybody is unique when it comes to their perception of smell, and not just because they're past associations, but because actually everyone, except if you have an identical twin, has a somewhat different set of olfactory receptors that are expressed that are detecting the scents that are all around us. So a rose is not a rose is not a rose. And where this really comes into play is in the differences with respect to intensity that people perceive things. So if people perceive something at a low intensity, they typically don't find it unpleasant. But if they experience at a super intense, like very, very strong, very, very high intensity, whatever it is, it could be a sound, it could be a light and so forth, it is definitely aversive. And the same thing goes for smell. So your wife may, in addition to not having your pleasant associations, also be more sensitive to some of the compounds that are in the smelly books. And so she's detecting something slightly different than you are.
Are there any smells that are universally associated or accepted in a positive manner, such as maybe, say, the smell of freshly cut grass or the smell of bacon cooking in the morning, stuff like that? Or is it, as you said, a case of a rose is not a rose is not a rose?
Well, actually, so you're bringing up some really good points with your example. So first of all, well, the answer is, I'll just answer it first. So the answer is, the only scent that's really kind of universally liked is the smell of vanilla. And that is because vanilla is actually a compound in both breast milk and formula. And everyone on the planet has been fed as an infant. And during that feeding, in addition to it being nourishing and nutritious and so forth, it's also a time you're cuddling, you know, the person is your mother is holding you or the caregiver is holding you warmly and tightly. And it's a loving, positive connection. So regardless of how you were first exposed to vanilla, whether it's in breast milk or in formula, there's a positive connotation and association to that. However, with bacon and fresh cut grass, actually, there is a very wide cultural differences that go along with that, part of which has to do with even experience. So in places where fresh cut grass is not happening, that is to say places where they don't have grass, or like you could imagine living in a city and never even experiencing what that is like, you're not going to have an association to that. It's not going to be something that's necessarily positive. And likewise, with respect to bacon, you know, there are various cultures that don't eat bacon, that find, you know, pig meat and so forth disgusting. You know, it's not kosher, it's not halal and so forth. And actually the smell of bacon to individuals that have a negative connotation of eating bacon is not necessarily pleasant. There are some people who don't eat bacon that still like the smell, but there are also people who do not like the smell for the emotional associations that they pin on the scent of bacon. And so It really has to do with your personal experiences. And what I'm bringing up also is how culture really dictates that, as well as your own idiosyncratic, unique connection. So we don't have to necessarily smell every scent and have a personal connection to it to decide that we like it or not. If our culture says that it's a good smell, then most likely we go into it the first time smelling it, liking it, or assuming that we like it. And so there's that, which has a big influence on us as well.
So something I do want to talk about in sort of a general sense, if you will, how the sense of smell works. And I mean, I'm talking about basic methodology on how the sense of smell works. My wife is the smart one of the two of us. She's the speech pathologist with the master's degree. I'm just the podcast guy who loves going to Vegas. So in the barest, most stripped down way possible, can you explain how that sense of smell works?
Okay, I'll give it a try. I've done this a few times, so hopefully it's coherent. Anyhow, so what smells are chemicals that float through the air, and we have an apparatus called the nose that inside of it has these receptors for detecting those chemicals that float through the air. Now, I should say that not every chemical that floats through the air is something that we can detect, and quite fascinatingly, the chemicals that make up the air that we breathe, so oxygen, helium, nitrogen, and so on, we actually cannot smell them. So it's like the air is a blank canvas on which the other smell chemicals that we do perceive are painted on, which I think is really an interesting kind of a thing. So we don't have interference from the background, as it were. But anyway, so when we inhale through our nostrils, the air that's in the room or wherever we are outside is carrying these various molecules in it. And as long as they have certain characteristics that they can fit into the receptors and connect with the receptors, then we can detect them. And actually, theoretically speaking, we can detect over a trillion different scents. And of course, though, that's not really physically possible because a trillion seconds is actually 32,000 years. So we would never even be able to do it. But theoretically, any chemical out there in the universe that, as long as it meets the criteria of being able to connect with our olfactory receptors, we can detect. Now, that being said, there are, as I already mentioned, a lot of differences in terms of people's sensitivity to specific odor chemicals. And that has to do with the genetics of the olfactory receptors that are different for every person, ever so slightly, and the number of copies that you have. And you could also be someone who has ostensibly a normal sense of smell, but you're missing a receptor for a particular kind of compound. And this is the example of, for example, people who hate the smell of cilantro. And it's actually, so people who hate the smell of cilantro think it smells like soap and, gross. Who would ever want to eat that? It's, terrible. And nobody wants to put that anywhere near their mouth or nose. And I'll get to explaining why what you think when you're eating, taste and so forth, is really to do with smell. But anyway, the people who think it just smells like soap and it's gross actually are missing the receptor that gives it the beautiful herbaceous quality that people who love the aroma of cilantro, myself, for example, included, why they like it so much. So there are these specific things where it's called a specific anosmia, where you could actually be missing just one type of receptor, but everything else is normal. Or you could be someone who's super sensitive to a certain kind of chemical, and therefore you need it to be far away from you or at low concentration, or it smells too strong. And so this is what's going on at the very basic level, sort of inside your nose. And then from your nose, the part of the brain, which is where the sense of smell is first processed, called the olfactory bulbs. And it's basically there are two of them, one for each side of the brain. And they're basically just at the level of your eyebrow, and they're about the size of a blueberry. And this is where the first stage of olfactory processing takes place. And then right after that, which is what gives our sense of smell such a unique and privileged and special connection to emotion and memory, is that the next place that information from the olfactory bulb goes is right to the limbic system, and specifically the amygdala and the hippocampus. And that's where both emotion, emotional memory, and associations take place. And none of our other sensory systems have this direct access to those brain areas. And that's why associations to smells are so immediately formed, and why, after they're formed, we have this instantaneous kind of emotional response to them, often without being able to put any words on it. And often, at least with respect to the development of the experience, there's no words at first. Sometimes we can get words, and sometimes we get a memory that comes back with it, but we can actually kind of exist with smells in pure scentscape, as it were. And this is also completely different from our other senses, where we're analyzing and we're cognitively recognizing, like, oh, that's a leaf, that's a tree, that's whatever, where we sometimes can't do that with our sense of smell. And in a way, it's the purest sense in that regard.
It's interesting that you mention about how those instantaneous associations are formed. I mean, in my head right now, I'm thinking of all the things, and maybe not necessarily on a pleasant level, but more on the not so pleasant level. I'm thinking about all the things that have those instantaneous emotional reactions. I mean, in my head, I think of, for example, the smell of sour milk or the smell of cat pee. And instantly it's like I can smell it without any of those things actually being here.
Well, that's actually pretty remarkable. And I do have to say that this concept of odor imagery, what you're talking about, so in the absence of the sour milk or the cat pee that you can kind of conjure in your mind's nose that smell, is something that a lot of people, myself included, would argue is you're not really doing. However, I mean, you're getting like kind of all the associated qualities of it, but not really the smell per se. However, certain people, and especially people that have had a lot of training in smell, like perfumers and so on, and maybe you, I mean, the individual differences with respect to this and people's personal lives, as a function of their extreme sort of training with smell, it does seem that those people may be able to form odor images. So that is to say, you can really smell in your mind's nose the sour milk, let's say, or if you're a perfumer or something better than that. But that seems to be something that other people, generally speaking, or the average person, can't really do. They can get this sort of all the feelings about it and go, oh, I know, that's disgusting. And they can visualize the, you know, the sour milk and everything like that. But they don't really have the same smell in the sensory sense as they would if they were literally sticking their nose into the sour milk. Does that make sense to you? Do you truly feel like you can really smell it?
You know what? Now that you put it that way, I think maybe I'm not actually smelling it per se, but I'm more reliving the reaction to that particular unpleasant scent. Does that make more sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's totally the case. I mean, often without having to, we can sort of think about smell and have remembered associations because smell is so visceral. So we can really feel like, you know, things that we don't like especially are easier to do. Because just from a biological perspective, we're more attuned to the bad things, and especially something that's maybe made us sick in the past. That's something that we want to make sure we stay away from. But the actual conjuring in your mind's nose sensation is very rare. And when it does happen, it seems to be connected to things that are neurologically not so good. So for instance, sometimes people before they get a migraine will have an aura where they can smell something. And that's usually not such a good thing because, you know, from the point of view of there's neurological things going on when you're getting a migraine. Likewise, prior to epilepsy seizures, some people get these sort of smell hallucinations. So it's not like your brain can't do it, but that when it does do it, it's typically something that's not sort of normal from the sort of general perspective. That being said, like I mentioned before, people who are really trained, who do this all day long, you know, smelling different things and learning the smells of different things, seem to maybe have an ability that the average person doesn't, in that being able to volitionally create that sensation just by thinking about it.
Is the sense of smell something that people maybe take for granted? I mean, everybody puts so much focus on their hearing or their sight. But I know from a personal side of things, I went through an experience where following a severe sinus infection, I actually completely lost my sense of smell and taste for a period of time. It eventually came back following a period of a distorted sense of smell and taste, which was not a lot of fun. But after several years of dealing with that and finally getting back to a level of normality, I have found that I personally, I will never take my sense of smell for granted again.
Okay, so I love that you told that story. I'm sad that it happened to you, but very glad that you recovered. And first of all, yes, absolutely, people take their sense of smell for granted. And it's actually what motivated me to write my first popular science book called The Scent of Desire, was the fact that I was an expert witness. The first time I'd ever done it, being an expert witness for a case involving the sense of smell, where this woman had lost her sense of smell in a car accident. And actually, the car accident had been pretty severe, but she was all put back together by the time I came in contact with her, except for her sense of smell was, in her case, permanently lost. And everything about her life had fallen apart and was unraveling in all kinds of really bad ways. And so my role in this particular case was to convince the insurance company that losing her sense of smell was actually something severe and not something trivial, which unfortunately is the presumption of both insurance companies and medical organizations. So for example, with respect to the insurance company program, this is based on what's known as the American Medical Association's value of life's worth on losing various, you know, body parts and functions and so forth. And just to give you an example, the sense of sight is valued at 85% of your life's worth in terms of if you were going to file a lawsuit because you became blind and you were calculating, let's say, how much lost income you would have because you couldn't do your previous job, then the insurance company would be, since they're using those metrics, obligated to, let's say, or if they're following that, say, okay, well, 85% of what you would have made, you know, that would be the insurance claim. With the sense of smell, what the American Medical Association gives it is between 1 to 5% of your life's worth. So basically, practically nothing. And yet that is so, so, so untrue. And I've been involved in a number of cases like this since then, demonstrating how actually every aspect of one's life, from social, sexual, personal, cognitive, sense of self, quality of life, health and safety, absolutely everything is really detrimentally impacted and unfortunately gets worse over time rather than stabilizing or getting better. Now, the other thing I want to say about your example of your upper respiratory tract infection has to do with COVID-19, which I don't know if you know, but there's actually loss of smell is a very important symptom with respect to this diagnostically. And I've been involved in a study recently where we found that loss of smell actually preceded a positive diagnosis of COVID-19 by 2 days. But in addition to that, there are people who, many people recover their sense of smell after the infection clears up. But there are other people who've had persistent smell loss and other people, again, who have this distorted sense of smell, like you're mentioning. They get their sense of smell back, but it's not good. Things don't smell good and not like they used to. Now, the encouraging news is that if we assume that COVID is like other upper respiratory tract infections, where there typically is over a period of time recovery of the sense of smell, then the good news is that people will get their sense of smell back. But, you know, given that COVID is sort of so new, and as in your case, it can sometimes take years, there are a lot of people that are very disturbed and upset right now about this loss of smell. And even during the illness itself, I've been contacted by people who've had COVID pretty badly, like obviously not to the point where they're, you know, really, really, really sick and so forth, but who had, you know, all the other symptoms pretty badly and said that their loss of sense of smell was actually the worst experience of the whole illness. So it is one of those things that as soon as you lose it, you realize how actually extremely important it was. And this woman that I was the expert witness for in this first case was really beside herself because she said, you know, she had always taken her sense of smell for granted and had no idea how much it was involved in everything, and really, really lamented the fact that she had always ignored it and never appreciated it before. So actually, my motivation in writing that first book was to get people to appreciate and realize how wonderful their sense of smell is and to, you know, take the time to stop to smell the roses. So, you know, if I can give anything as a bottom line, you know, use your nose while you can, because we all get older and we tend to, you know, decrease our sensitivity by just aging like we do with our other senses.
Yeah. I mean, I can honestly say it was one of the most difficult times of my life to go through that. I mean, I'm a person who loves to wake up to the smell of coffee. That was my thing for so long. And while I was going through the distorted sense of smell, I could barely drive past a Starbucks or a Tim Hortons or whatever equivalent coffee shop in the US without wanting to vomit. It was that bad for me. And the other weird thing about it was, it was worse when it was a dispersed smell, if that makes sense. Like I could stick my nose right into a cup of coffee and take a big whiff and no problem. But if I was far away and it was up in the air, it was absolutely horrific.
Well, that's actually really interesting. And, you know, I don't know that much about the sort of clinical like experience that you're reporting, like in terms of, is it more the case that when people have these distortions, that it's when it's diluted in a lot of airspace, for example, compared to when you're just like really embedded in it? So that's actually something which I would love to look into more now that you've mentioned this, if there is any data kind of about the fact that it's maybe the contamination with other smell molecules that are out there that then wash out, let's say, the coffee aroma, and maybe there is like some tiny bit of onion smell in the background, let's just say, and you're just picking that up instead, or somehow the interaction of different smell compounds in the air causes this to happen. So that's something I'm going to have to look into after this is over. I'm going to ask some people that I know about this.
Look at me, a weird medical freak of nature.
Well, maybe not. I mean, maybe this is what people normally experience. I mean, that's what I'd like to look into, because I think that would be in and of itself really interesting. Like if you were just exposed to the one scent, then that might be okay. But if it's diluted with a lot of other scents, maybe that's where the problem comes in. I mean, that could help people in terms of trying to resolve this distortion, which is called parosmia in technical medical terms. That could help them in terms of maybe recovering from this. If we know that if you just, let's say, for example, stick your nose in coffee a whole bunch of times, maybe that would help you get that real coffee aroma back, even when you're, 100 feet from the Starbucks.
I look forward to hearing about that research, because again, that's something that it affected me in such a huge way. Like I can see where the person that you were working with is coming from on this, because for me, I slipped into, I don't want to say a deep depression, but again, as a fat kid who loved to eat and loved to drink coffee, thank God one of the only things that didn't smell or taste bad was beer. That was fantastic. I was so happy about that. I thought if beer and barbecued steak goes bad for me, that's it, I'm done.
Oh, well, very good. So, well, good. I'm glad to hear that. But yeah, I mean, actually, the first person I worked with, and this is the case for everyone I've worked with, a deep depression is exactly what sets in. And not just because it's like lamenting the loss, but actually because of the neurobiology between smell and emotion processing in the brain. When one side of that equation starts to misfire, as it were, malfunction, the other side is negatively impacted. And something that's really interesting, so not only does loss of sense of smell actually create depression that actually unfortunately continues to worsen over time, but when people who have major depression are in a major depressive episode, their sense of smell becomes much weaker. And so there really is this very fascinating bi-directional relationship between our sense of smell and our emotional health.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.
Rachel, I brought you on here today because I wanted to talk to you about the scent in Las Vegas. And I'm not talking about the smell of desperation and lost money and stale nicotine hanging in the air of the casinos. Everybody who's been to Vegas knows that all of these casinos and hotels and resorts, they all have a very distinct smell. And as anybody who's a bit of a Vegas insider knows, nothing in Vegas happens by accident. This is all on purpose. So I guess the big question that's on my mind here is, how can and how do businesses use scent to influence their customers or their guests?
Well, there actually is a big area of what's known as scent marketing, and I have done consulting for a number of different kinds of companies on this exact topic. And the two ways that this sort of works is, one, to create an ambience that connects the experience of whatever the product is or the environment is with the smell that's in the air to enrich the experience. So that is to say, I'm going to make this a much deeper, more powerful, more profound experience by adding in smell that works with whatever the merchandise is or whatever the concept is. And that will make people buy more or spend more or whatever. And the other is to create these sort of scent logos in a way, or signature scents, where after you've, let's say, and this works more with the resort or the casino concept than, let's say, with a clothing store. But if you were, for instance, there was a scent of a particular casino, and let's say also the bath products and the hotel room was scented with those sorts of things too, and then you have that unique scent signature that's connected to that particular resort, when you either steal those bath products and bring them back home with you and then sniff them again, or if you buy the products that are connected, there are, you know, you can purchase the sort of sprays and so forth, as you pointed out to me, of various casinos, that when you smell them, that reminds you of that great time that you had when you were gambling and hopefully won a little bit of money, but also you had this wonderful time in Vegas. You saw all these shows. You had this, you know, such a wonderful, gorgeous resort you were at and so on. And it's going to make you then want to go back, but specifically go back to that particular resort or casino. So you build this sort of brand affiliation and brand association where when the person goes back home to a regular life, they can be reminded of that specific experience and that particular casino with scent and then want to reinvest, as it were, in that property and go back there again.
It's interesting that you say that, because I've had that exact experience where I've been standing somewhere, whether I'm in a store or on a train or wherever, and somebody walks by me and they're wearing a perfume, and instantaneously it's like, that smells like Aria.
Well, I'll give you a personal experience, and not to necessarily plug the Wynn, but the Wynn and Encore Casino Resort is actually where my husband and I first stayed before we were married, and when we got married, and where we always stay. And of course, it also has a signature scent. And they've changed, they've actually changed it from what it was originally when we were first there. But when I was first there, the first couple of times we went there, I, of course, did steal the soap and the shampoo and the conditioner and body lotion and so forth. And I have it still to this day. And in fact, I just opened up a new bar recently because of exactly that, you know, especially right now. I can't go to Vegas and would love to. In fact, my husband and I were just kind of talking about this the other day about, oh, I can't believe it's been 3 years since we've been there, because we tend to go at least every, you know, year or two. At least that's been the tradition so far. And having that scent was sort of a nice little reminder. And that is something that I deliberately did because, you know, I know about this connection. You know, that is part of the whole sequence where this is what people do.
Now, are there, and we kind of hit on this a little bit earlier in regards to the whole idea of pleasant smells, memory and emotion and things like that. But when it comes to these scent logos or signature scents, are there certain smells that are more effective than others?
Well, the one thing that is important, I mean, one of the things to say is that it's important to have a scent that's not like another scent, because you want to be distinctive. It's also the case that somehow you need to make your scent perceived as thematically congruent with the merchandise, as it were. So in a clothing store, for example, if I use this, it's easier. You could imagine that a high-end men's clothing store, for example, might have a scent of clean, fresh linen in the store, and that would connect with the merchandise that's being sold. And that customers would then form this kind of connection in their mind. And like that would sort of, that not only would, sort of, this has actually been shown, heighten the perceived quality of the clothing and increase how much people are willing to spend when they're in the store. Now, if I took a smell that people liked just as much as clean, fresh linen, like I evaluated these scents ahead of time and I had people rate how much they like them, clean, fresh linen scores, whatever. And then I have another scent, let's call it some combination of fresh cut grass and let's say coconut. And people liked it just as much. And I have that in my high-end men's clothing store. People are going to be like, what is this? I mean, it's nice, I guess, but doesn't fit at all with the merchandise being sold. And so actually that backfires. People stay in the space less length of time, which also leads to less spending. And it certainly does not increase the perceived value of what's being sold. In fact, it can decrease the perceived value. So the very important thing is to somehow create this idea of thematic congruence between what is being sold and what the scent in the air is. Now, with a casino or a resort, because it's more on the sort of aspirational concept level, it can be somewhat more difficult than when you're dealing with concrete merchandise like clothing. However, it can also be the case that, you know, you can hit upon it for a certain segment of the population that's visiting your resort, but miss the mark with others. So, I mean, this is one of the problems also with, even with the clothing store example, is that depending upon my demographic, you know, let's say people in their, men in their 50s are going to go, yes, that clean, fresh linen smell is totally the scent that works for me. And I'm going to spend more money on this, you know, shirt and suit and so on. But maybe someone who's 20 who walks in there is like, no, you know, for me, the clean flesh linen is not working. You know, the scent that I associate with crisp quality clothing is, let's say, a citrus smell, because that's the scent of, let's say, the laundry detergent that I connect with high class clothing. So one of the problems that places who use scent marketing have is trying to figure out what the right smell is for the concept and also hitting the mark with their key demographic. And so those are sort of the ingredients that go into figuring out what the right scent for the right environment is.
Well, and I was just going to ask about the risk associated with creating these signature scents, because as you alluded to earlier, and as we discussed, not everyone enjoys the same scents, and there's different levels of scent sensitivity. I mean, the risk could be that you put this scent in the air, and as you say, you could drive people out, even if those people are in your key demographic. To that degree, you could almost say it's better to not have a signature scent.
I agree. And that's actually can be a real problem. And, you know, one of the things also that I would say, just as a kind of a cautionary note, I mean, everything in Vegas is extreme, you know, big, bold, loud, you know, huge colors, huge, you know, everything. And one of the issues that I would say is a caution to resorts and casinos using this is to not have their smell too strong. I mean, the problem is it does have to mask the smell of, you know, disappointment and body odor and maybe stale cigarette smoke, you know, not in casinos most of the time these days, but nevertheless, it has to cover up some negative odors and maybe also compete with the aromas coming from restaurants or the food court and so on. But at the same time, if it's too strong, and especially in terms of the first impression, let's say when people are first walking into the lobby area of a resort, if they're blasted too much with scent, then that sort of intensity could actually be negative, even if at a lower intensity they might like it. And this is not even taking into consideration the fact that certain individuals are going to be particularly sensitive to aspects of the bouquet and others are going to be less so. So less is actually more, although you have to sort of walk a fine line if you're trying to cover up, you know, other scents that you don't want people to smell.
It's funny that you say that, because I always found there's two resorts or casinos in Vegas that always kind of struck me with that. One was the Cromwell and the second one was Caesar's Palace. And my wife, mm-hmm. who's not particularly scent sensitive, other than to my grandfather's musty old books, we would always comment when we would walk into Caesar's Palace, I always said it felt like you were being slapped in the nostrils.
Yeah, so that's a good example. And I don't know to the extent that you, I mean, so did your wife have the same impression or did she not?
To a slightly less degree. But for me, it was always just like, as soon as you walk through that door, bam, there was the Caesar smell.
And is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, it's a weird balance of that, because you were kind of ready for it. and it didn't really affect you in a super negative way because you're like, hey, I'm in Vegas, I'm at Caesar's Palace. But at the same time, it was like, oh, they need to dial this down at just a couple of notches.
Yeah. So I think you're actually hitting on two really good and important marks there. One of them is that, you know, when you're in Vegas, you're generally in a good mood. You're ready for a good time. You're there because it's a holiday vacation. You're going to have fun. You're going to party, whatever the case is. So your emotional state that you're connecting with the scent that's there is really good. And so the scent is going to become good because of the emotional state you're in. And yet at the same time, exactly what you're saying, that is something, if it's too strong, is just a little unpleasant because it's too strong. And so I do think that sort of the dialing it down is an important thing to do. And one thing, unfortunately, that a lot of companies do, when I speak to them, I always say, you know, you need to actually do a little bit of testing. You can't just go, okay, I think this is a good idea, let's go for it. So you need to actually assess, you know, on average, people walking through that door, do they feel like you? Do they feel like, you know, turn it down? In which case, they should turn it down. So that's something to consider. I mean, one of the other things is that in terms of adaptation, I mean, we all, unfortunately or fortunately, depending on what the situation is, lose our ability to detect an odor after we've spent any amount of time sort of with it. So you walk into Caesar's Palace and you're like, bam, there's that scent. Really intense, but probably after about 20 minutes, you're barely detecting it anymore. And the more scent that's there, they can have like kind of a dual effect. It's at one level, you don't adapt to it as quickly because it's so there that you can still smell it for, let's say, a longer period of time than if there was a very weak smell in the room that you would more quickly adapt to. But from the point of view of kind of the long-term effect of that, losing the sensitivity to it, that can actually be stronger. So you do want people to be able to still smell that scent. Like, let's say they go out and then they, you know, come back in, and you want them to be able to smell that again. You want them to be able to smell it, you know, just as strongly for, let's say, the week that they're in Vegas as the first time they walked in. Because if by the end of the week you don't smell anything anymore, that's also a bad thing. So if it's too strong, that might happen. Although I know most people don't spend a week there. But still, if people were there for a longer period of time, you'd want the smell to be as intense on Friday as it was on Sunday. And so if it's too strong, that may also decrease more than you would want it to. So there is a fine balance, and resorts and casinos need to actually do some boots on the ground, real testing to find out like where the perfect amount of intensity is.
It's interesting that you say that because, yeah, there are other casinos and resorts on the Strip that you can walk into, and it's much more subtle. Like, for example, the Flamingo, I always find you walk in there, you kind of get that first little just slight whiff of the, I always say it kind of smells almost like the old copper tone coconut suntan lotion, but you get that first whiff, and then maybe every once in a while you get the odd little whiff of it, as opposed to, as I say, Caesar's Palace, where you walk in and it's like you're getting kicked in the nostrils.
Right. And I think it's interesting, like what kind of impression the difference between those scents is making. I mean, there's also kind of a big conceptual difference between the Flamingo and Caesar's Palace, and maybe also a demographic difference in terms of the patrons who prefer one versus the other, and so on. So there is kind of an interesting combination of difference going on and how the individual who goes into it perceives it. So, you know, and that's something that the casino itself should be thinking about when they, you know, set up whatever scenting they're going to have.
Well, Rachel, this has been incredibly eye-opening for me and incredibly fascinating. And I'm sure my listeners have found it just as fascinating. And I just want to thank you for taking time to jump on with me here today and chat all about the amazing world of the science and psychology of scent.
Well, Jeff, this has been really fun to talk to you, and I really appreciate you inviting me on.
And that wraps up another episode of Jeff Does Vegas. If you've got feedback on this episode of the show, or any other episode for that matter, or you've got suggestions and ideas for topics you'd like me to cover on the podcast, please feel free to reach out via social media on Facebook, X, or Instagram at Jeff Does Vegas. You can also email me directly at jeff@jeffdoesvegas.com. In the meantime, thanks for checking out the show. Be sure to follow us wherever you get your podcasts so you'll be notified the instant a new episode is released. While you're there, go ahead and rate us and write a review. And don't forget to visit jeffdoesvegas.com for past episodes, show notes, Vegas deals, and more. My name is Jeff, and this has been Jeff Does Vegas, a Walker New Media production.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.